at the top of the hour by the computer. Looks like I should fine-tune the console clock here. Sonali Kalhatar did a great feature with a woman from Professor Gottlieb. I think she's a prof somewhere. But she talks in common language. It's not too nerdy. The no Mumia today. I'm worried about him. Maybe he's finishing a book and working on his new court case. He has a basic case challenging his verdict. It's put him in jail for so long. And I think he's got a pretty good shot at it myself, having looked at it. You can go to prisonradio.net, I believe it is, and look there for material from other people. They usually run on longer. Mumia is very concise, generally. And, okay. Well, there we go. Sorry about that. I was navigating my material. Oh, I have a short feature from the short excerpt from the Intercepted, actually, which I definitely want to get to, at least a section of it, because it's about the Pipeline 3 protests in Minnesota. A little material on other areas as well. And it's an important issue, and it sort of, in my mind, is right there with water protection. They're doing it at a great scale. Amy Goodman, about the Texans again, and voter rights. I haven't actually heard this one yet. So Barbara Gottlieb of Scientists for Social Responsibility harkens back to the Physicians for Social Responsibility who in the Vietnam era who were one of the first groups that were blowing the alarm about Agent Orange and dioxin in our chemical warfare in Indochina. Makes me want to recount a story about seeing Margaret Mead at the first and only American Association Advancement of Science conference I attended in 71. But I won't. Ask me about it on the street. I want to get this material on. Maybe I'll put that on at the very end. Thanks for tuning in. Help support community media. You'll be getting an envelope in the mail, so sort through that stuff, all that junk mail you get, and look for the WEF logo. Amy Goodman's commentary, Breaking the Sound Barrier, presently.
The Lone Star All-Stars don't mess with Texas's voting rights. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan in our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. Don't mess with Texas, reads a popular bumper sticker in the Lone Star State, which Republican lawmakers are clearly ignoring. Governor Greg Abbott convened a special legislative session intent on passing a draconian voter suppression law. Critics have dubbed it the suppression session. In response, almost every Democratic representative in the Texas House fled the state, denying the Republican majority a quorum. At least 50 Democrats flew to Washington, D.C., where they're pressing Congress to pass H.R. 1-S1, the For the People Act, which would expand rather than shrink the number of people who vote in our elections. Governor Abbott told Austin's ABC affiliate,
"As soon as they come back in the state of Texas, they will be arrested. They will be cabined inside the Texas Capitol until they get their job done."
Speaking from Washington, D.C., Texas Representative Trey Martinez Fisher from San Antonio said on the Democracy Now! News Hour,
"I don't like being told that I'm going to be corralled or cabined like I'm a piece of property. For especially for minority lawmakers that's especially sensitive.
The voter suppression bills would disproportionately impact people of color and residents of urban centers like Houston, the fourth most populous city in the nation and one of the most diverse. The bills ban drive-through voting and 24-hour voting centers. They ban election officials from mailing unsolicited absentee ballot applications and tighten photo identification requirements. The rationale for the so-called election integrity bills, say the Republicans, is to combat voter fraud, which has been repeatedly proven to be almost non-existent.
The attorney general that wants to get all up in arms, who has every opportunity to prosecute election fraud, his office said, well, we've had 44 cases, not just in 2020, but over the years, 44 cases.
That's African-American Democratic State Representative Jasmine Crockett speaking to Democracy Now, also from Washington, D.C.
Compare and contrast that with the fact that we have 30 million people in the state of Texas and we had 700 die in the winter storm. So you tell me, do we need to talk about the integrity of our electrical grid, or do we need to talk about the integrity of our election system?
Texas' devastating electrical grid failure is not on the agenda for the special session. The effort to further restrict voting rights in Texas follows passage of 17 similar laws in states like Georgia. Massive voter turnout in the African-American and other minority communities there won Georgia for Biden in 2020. Then, in a special election, Democrats Jonathan Ossoff and Reverend Raphael Warnock unseated Georgia's incumbent Republican senators, delivering the Senate majority to the Democrats. Warnock is up for re-election in 2022. Until recently, racist barriers to voting in Texas, Georgia, and elsewhere could have been struck down under the Voting Rights Act, the VRA, passed in 1965 after decades of struggle and bloodshed during the Civil Rights Movement. The increasingly ultra-conservative U.S. Supreme Court, though, continues to gut the act. First, the court, under Chief Justice John Roberts, eviscerated the Act's Section 5 preclearance requirement with its 5-4 decision in the 2013 Shelby County versus Holder case. Section 5 required states with long histories of racist disenfranchisement to have any change in their voting laws pre-cleared by the Department of Justice. On July 1st, the Supreme Court gutted another key piece of the VRA, Section 2, in its partisan 6-3 decision in Brnovich versus DNC. Republican Mark Brnovich, a former private prison industry lobbyist, is currently Arizona's attorney general. He defended an Arizona law making it more difficult for citizens of color to vote in Democratic strongholds like Maricopa County, Arizona's most populous, diverse county. Many of the Texas Democrats in Washington are also joining progressives who are pressuring President Biden and Congress to do away with the Senate filibuster, seen as the major obstacle preventing passage of the For the People Act. Biden did not mention the filibuster in his major voting rights address this week. South Carolina Democratic Congress member James Clyburn has proposed a filibuster carve-out specifically for voting rights bills.
And this is a long game. This is a marathon, and I'm not looking for an overnight success.
Again, that's Texas State Representative Trey Martinez Fisher.
We need to continue to fight the fight, and how, you know, our actions today are very reflective of the actions of Frederick Douglass, the suffragettes, and all the folks who fought for the Voting Rights Act in 1965.
Texas Representative Martinez Fisher's words echoed those of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who said,
"The arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice."
Republican leaders like Governor Abbott recognize they can't win with their policies, so they continually try to reduce the number of those who can vote against them. This time, they've provoked a group of Texans who won't be messed with, the Lone Star All-Stars. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
Okay. Guess I'll be looking for Pacifica material on Haiti and Cuba both tomorrow. I think it was on Amy Goodman's show, the only place I heard that there were pretty large counter-demonstrators in Cuba to the anti-government ones. But we don't hear about that. And in most sources, I think it's an important thing to hear some of the other side. Gonna kick it with this Line 3 protester excerpt, just a short excerpt, and then lead into the new revelations from the social responsibility group. This should all be in my notes, right? But where are my notes? Rising Up with Sonali has the piece with, I think that's mislabeled. Jimena Pierre is the woman who's about talking about Haiti with Sonali, which I'll probably put on tomorrow. Oh, okay, they're both Physicians for Social Responsibility. It is, so that longstanding group talking about PFAS in fracking. That nerdy enough. But let's kick it off from on the ground in Minnesota. And I think this will probably be about where I want to begin. And I realized that this would be a good fold-in right at the last minute. So.
My name is Bigwind. I use they, them pronouns, and I am the communications coordinator for GNU. I was at NMEWAG yesterday, and there was a Department of Homeland Security helicopter that flew really, 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 really low, like just right above the tree, right above the tree line.
Bigwin describes what members of the indigenous-led anti-pipeline movement, also known as water protectors, have recently encountered from police along the route.
At first you could hear it. It was like choppers, and you could feel it in the ground. And it was circling camp. It circled camp twice. And wow. You could tell it was intentional, and it was to intimidate us and to surveil us.
Bigwin says it was a Department of Homeland Security helicopter, just as a masked police officer approaches us.
And this is consistent with the continuation. We see the police taking a more escalated response to the actions that have been happening here.
Mm-hmm. Could you describe that escalated response? Because I'm the police.
Yeah.
And I'd argue with you that we haven't taken an escalated response. We've had a very even-keeled response.
That's Sheriff Dan Gaida of Aitkin County. Sheriff Gaida is here in response to Enbridge's complaints about the road blockade. He's waiting for a trailer full of equipment that officers will use to remove the lockdown demonstrators.
Okay, well, I'm not going to sit here and argue with you because
what's the escalated response? Did you see?
They're asking me a question. We're in an interview and you just interrupted that. That's what I'm saying.
I was
literally talking about how there was a helicopter flying over, a DHS helicopter, and you just interrupted my conversation.
We have no helicopters. We haven't been in any helicopters.
Okay.
The stories you tell need to be true.
we have footage that shows that there was a Department of Homeland Security helicopter flying over.
I thought you didn't want to argue.
Well, now what you're doing to me.
Take a look at badges around here and find me a Department of Homeland Security. There's none here. There's nobody here from Department of Homeland Security. That's federal. We don't do that.
Sheriff Gaida is proud of his recent record. Despite an influx of activists as the winter cold eased, his deputies had avoided making any arrests the prior week.
I don't call that an escalated response. I call it exceptional public safety. Don't tell lies about cops.
The sheriff and I step aside to talk further. I ask him about the special Enbridge-funded account that the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission set up to reimburse law enforcement expenses. For water protectors, the funding from Enbridge positions the police as biased toward the company, or at worst, private operatives for Enbridge. Sheriff Gaida assures me there is nothing wrong with the pipeline company's payments for police services.
There's been a lot of criticism around this escrow account that's been set up.
Yeah, and some people were saying that today, take your cops. Enbridge doesn't pay for us.
Mm-hmm.
It's a reimbursement for expenses that are related to this line that we wouldn't normally have.
He points toward a government-appointed account manager who approves every Enbridge transaction.
Enbridge is reimbursing a lot of stuff, but
is not reimbursing. Don't get confused. That PUC account is all managed by the state of Minnesota.
He adds,
I don't think that we have any connections with Enbridge, but there's a good separation.
A few days later, the sheriff left me a voicemail.
Hi, Eileen. This is Dan Gaida. Hey, I was in a meeting this morning, and I asked specifically about helicopters, and I found out that a county in the western side of the state did have a helicopter coming from, I don't know if it was Immigrations or who, but they had a helicopter come in and buzz the camp over there. It was not in our county, as I said, but I do have to apologize because there was a helicopter that buzzed the camp.
Big Wind's camp, NMEWAG, is in a neighboring county, and it turns out Gaida was unaware that another sheriff did call in Customs and Border Protection. In short, Big Wind wasn't lying, and Gaida's understanding of what was happening in the battle between the pipeline company and the water protectors was incomplete. For water protectors, the escalating Enbridge-funded policing and the denials to press are part of a pattern. Law enforcement working hand-in-hand with pipeline companies to police their opposition. than refuting that a collaboration exists. From Standing Rock to Jordan Cove, private and public resources are put in service of what water protectors say amount to a counterinsurgency against their efforts to save the planet from the fossil fuel industry. Counterinsurgency typically refers to a strategy used by the military to defeat armed resistance. It involves not just threats of violence, but also psychological, political, economic, and intelligence tactics. In Minnesota, the label is more than just semantic. The state permit for the Line 3 pipeline includes an unusual condition. Quote, the permittee's contractors and assigns, will not participate in counterinsurgency tactics or misinformation campaigns to interfere with the rights of the public to legally exercise their constitutional rights.
They were told not to do, what is it, counterinsurgency? It's the exact term they've used. I don't understand how surveilling, harassing, and targeting people on a daily basis is not counterinsurgency. You are specifically targeting Indigenous people, people of color, anyone that's associated with, like, are you a water protector? You know what I mean? Like, those things have happened multiple times. And this is, like, spanned back years.
Tara Hauska is a 37-year-old Anishinaabe water protector from Minnesota and a veteran of the fight at Standing Rock.
I've seen a lot of drone activity over the last few years, and it's been more and more recently.
Water protectors say Enbridge has violated its permit conditions. They point to the escrow account created for Enbridge to pay law enforcement for pipeline policing, intensifying surveillance, and a years-long divide-and-conquer effort by the company aimed at local communities. I interviewed dozens of people, reviewed thousands of pages of public records and academic literature, all suggesting Enbridge and the police's efforts bear hallmarks of corporate counterinsurgency.
So you can find that at The Intercepted, under The Intercepted podcast, corporate counterinsurgency against Line 3 pipeline resistance. And now without further ado, we'll go to the segment with Sonali Kalatar interviewing about what I find to be totally shocking. We've been hearing about PFAS stories, well, I have anyway, forever chemicals. Now it turns out they're using it to lubricate their fracking, and it's proprietary, so even the EPA won't reveal to the physicians for social responsibility what is being injected. So beyond the leaking of methane, which is also intrinsic to fracking, we've got this other longer-term, like, forever problem. Good morning.
This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. About a decade ago, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency overruled its own research over the toxicity of so-called forever chemicals that are used in hydraulic fracturing or fracking operations. The revelation about the per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, or PFAS, came from the group Physicians for Social Responsibility via newly obtained documents from the EPA. According to a new PSR report, oil and gas firms injected these chemicals into more than 1,200 wells since 2012. My guest is Barbara Gottlieb, Environment and Health Program Director with Physicians for Social Responsibility. Welcome to the program, Barbara.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
So these so-called forever chemicals, what are they? And what did you find out that the EPA knew about them in, you know, about 10 years ago in 2011, 2012?
Well, the chemicals that we discovered were being used in fracking operations are PFAS chemicals, which is to say they're part of a very large family of highly toxic man-made chemicals that are very dangerous due to their toxicity, of course, and also because they last in the environment and they don't break down. That has given them the nickname of forever chemicals. They seem to last in the environment forever. And another problem with these chemicals is they build up in the human body. If you ingest one of these chemicals, if you get one of these chemicals into your body, it doesn't come out, it stays there. So that means that the risk, because of their toxicity, just compounds and compounds with more and more exposures.
How did you find out about this information? So I understand it was a Freedom of Information request that your organization, Physicians for Social Responsibility, submitted, and you were able to get this internal information from our government agency, the EPA?
That's right. The EPA responded to an FOIA or FOIA request submitted by a researcher who was not at that time working with PSR. His name is Dusty Horwitt. He's a great researcher, and we were really glad to bring him into PSR in order to produce this report. He asked them about chemicals that were used in oil and gas fracking and drilling, and they sent him thousands of pages. That was a few years ago. It took him a couple of years to work his way through the 1,000 pages, but he kept on pulling out more and more really interesting information. The problem with information that comes from the EPA about chemicals that they're considering for approval is that the companies that produce these chemicals are allowed to black out, make invisible to the public the specific information about their chemicals. So he got reams of redacted documents and had to put the pieces together. But when the pieces were put together, what we found out is that the EPA approved chemicals for use in oil and gas operations that they themselves knew were either PFAS, a part of that family of really dangerous chemicals, or else could degrade into PFAS. And the EPA, in their consent order, actually acknowledged some of the specific health impacts that these toxic chemicals could have, and then they approved the chemicals anyway.
So if you go to the EPA's website and you look up PFAS, these per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, PFAS, it's very clear that the EPA warns that these chemicals can be found in food packaging and commercial household products and even in the workplace and in industries, electronics producing industries, and that after rigorous scientific review that the EPA has, you know, assessed the toxicity for these chemicals, etc. So it is very aware, even publicly, these chemicals are toxic. Why did it approve of the use of these chemicals in hydraulic fracturing? I mean, if this was in 2011, 2012, this was during the Obama administration.
Right. It was during the Obama administration. And I feel that's disappointing. I can't speculate about why they approved. Well, I could speculate, but I suppose I won't speculate about why they approved these chemicals. They did know plenty about these chemicals. They had been involved in some major lawsuits or disagreements, let's say, with DuPont Chemical, who was producing other kinds of PFAS chemicals years earlier and came to a settlement agreement with them. They knew what they were dealing with. Why they approved them, I don't know. I would only add that was 10 years ago. The law under which the EPA reviews chemicals that are likely to be dangerous, the so-called Toxic Substances Control Act, or TSCA, was amended somewhat in 2016. And so I hope that gives the EPA a tougher regimen and a sharper lens through which to look at dangerous chemicals. And there is a new administration. There's a new administrator in the EPA, Mr. Michael Regan. We're very glad to see him there. And PSR has said we'd be happy to work with him and the EPA to make sure that we get better protection for people from these really dangerous toxic chemicals.
So why are these chemicals used, I should say, in fracking operations? Your report found there were about 1,200 operations where these chemicals were used. Well, what do they actually do for hydraulic fracturing? And then do they just seep into the water and the soil?
So these PFAS chemicals are used to increase the slickness, if you will, of the underground movement of liquids that, when forced underground in fracking, crack open the shale and let the gas escape. So that's how the extraction takes place of natural gas or of oil from underground shale formations. Sometimes these chemicals are used in food packaging. Sometimes they're used on umbrellas. Sometimes they're used on firefighters' turnout gear because they're sort of water repellent and they can make water run more smoothly, or you know, run off your umbrella or move more smoothly through an underground well. That's my understanding of why these chemicals are used. Of course, that in a sense is speculation because in the documents that we received from the EPA, we weren't told where they were being used, why they were being used. These things had to be pieced together from a variety of sources.
So they seep into the, I am assuming, the water and the soil, possibly the air, and they stay there until they might get absorbed into the soil. They might enter the human body if they're either through the water or the soil, and then cause severe harm for especially people living around fracking operations.
Let's step back a few words in that, and let's just look a little bit more about how they get injected underground and where they go. So in fracking, the operator of the well will inject massive quantities, millions, literally millions of gallons of water mixed with chemicals, We don't really know what all of these chemicals are. We just learned that they may include PFAS chemicals, and they're injected at really high pressure underground. This has the effect of cracking open the rocks, as I was saying. And then the water and this chemical mix, as well as underground substances, underground water that may be highly salty, a lot of this water is brought back up to the surface as wastewater. That wastewater can then be loaded into trucks and trucked along highways, trucked through your neighborhood, trucked past farms and schools, and eventually taken somewhere to be disposed of. That happens sometimes in deep underground wells where it's injected once again at high pressure. Sometimes it's at such high pressure that the wastewater causes earthquakes. It's, I mean, it's really an astonishing industrial process, but it's dangerous all along that, that the supply chain that I've just described. So within the wells, yes, they do try to remove the wastewater. Sometimes they actually use it for fracking again. Some of it stays underground. Where exactly that water goes depends entirely on the geology of the site, of the individual well. And I think we really don't know where it goes. If the well goes through an aquifer, and if the well bore, the shaft of the well, which is coated in cement, if that cracks and leaks, we'll never know. So there are the threats associated with the water that remains underground. There are the threats with the water when it comes back up to the surface, and there are threats with the wastewater when it is used, we don't know where, or injected wherever. So that creates a very long chain of points at which people could be exposed. And of course, it is most dangerous to the workers in working on these wells, or to residents living right near these wells. And some of the wells are in rural areas. Some of them are in suburbs. Some of them are even in the city of Los Angeles. So the number of people who are potentially exposed to these chemicals is very high and very worrisome.
Let's talk about what PSR is recommending needs to happen. I assume that cleanup is one issue, but while you're cleaning up, a moratorium of sorts on using these chemicals, and the longer term picture maybe on either banning them altogether and or simply banning the practice of fracking, which, as we're in the midst of this incredible heat wave here in the south and western regions of the U.S., could only be a benefit to us in the long term if fracking were to be banned. So what are the things that PSR is calling on the government to do in light of these revelations that you put forth in the report?
Well, Sonali, you're so right. There are a number of things that either the EPA could do or state governments could do. A ban on fracking would be fantastic, and that is one of the positions that PSR definitely holds. We support a ban on fracking. We know that fracking is allowing the release of methane into the atmosphere, which is driving climate change and these incredible heat waves. We know that the more we pursue fracking, the more we squeeze out the rapid transition that we need to clean and healthy renewable energy sources. But in the shorter run, there are steps that can be taken. A moratorium on using these chemicals is one. But we need, even prior to that, we need to have studies. There needs to be examination, quantified testing of sites where these chemicals have been used to see if they have leaked. We need more testing done on these chemicals to see precisely, as I mentioned, PFAS is a really large family of dangerous chemicals. We need to know for these specific chemicals, what are their potential impacts on the human body. We know that they could cause cancer, they could cause birth defects, they could cause toxicity to the male reproductive system. I mean, we're talking about really dangerous chemicals that can do severe harm. We need to know more about that. We also call on the companies that use these chemicals to be held responsible for the costs of testing and cleanup. That's really important. This should not fall on local residents. It should fall on the companies that are potentially creating these harms.
I imagine that with this documentation in hand, residents of areas where fracking is very prominent and also organizers that are working on ending fracking might be able to use this as evidence in lawsuits or even as a basis of a lawsuit if the government takes no action now that this information is known?
Well, lawsuits fall a little bit outside my area of expertise. It sounds like a really exciting possibility, but PSR is working with a number of allies to help put this information in the hands of people, of communities all across the country that do have fracking, because fracking takes place in more than 30 states around the United States. It's not just Texas, it's not just Pennsylvania. It's a really very widespread industrial process, and that's one of the reasons why we're so concerned.
What do we know about how long these chemicals have been in use? Your organization, the documents that formed the basis of this report show that the EPA found out and moved ahead a little, or just around 10 years ago. But I assume that wasn't the first time these chemicals were used. We might have had these chemicals in use for decades.
Well, I think we really don't know. I mean, once again, it's been so difficult to figure out what's been used and where it's been used. Again, the process of redacting these documents, it's sometimes ridiculous. I've seen documents where you can't see the name of the company that is requesting permission to use these chemicals.
I mean, this is the Environmental Protection Agency of the government of the United States, a taxpayer-funded agency whose job it is to protect our environment for us, and it's redacting the names of private corporations in order to protect them. It's quite remarkable.
You know, the laws don't always work to protect us. The companies are allowed to invoke confidential business information protections. Why their name and their location would be part of confidential business information is a little bit beyond me. I understood that the law would mean that they couldn't give us the precise recipe for these chemical concoctions that they come up with. But apparently their protections under these laws is far more sweeping than that. Clearly the laws were made with their interests in mind and not with ours.
So PSR's website is the best place to get a hold of this document so that people can find out more about it and look through it themselves?
Absolutely right. We're at www.psr.org. And if you want to go straight to the documents, it's www.psr.org/frackingchemicals. Pretty easy.
And we'll post a link to that from our website later as well. Barbara, I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
My guest has been Barbara Gottlieb. She is the Environment and Health Program Director with the group Physicians for Social Responsibility. We've been discussing a new PSR report on how the EPA had approved the use of toxic chemicals in fracking. These are chemicals called PFAS or forever chemicals. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our newsletter and watch all our video interviews. You can also find our audio podcast on iTunes and on Spotify. And follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RUWithSonali.
I'm down with Sonali. That's produced out of KPFK, and I think it's coming out fairly regularly. PFAS. It reminds me that there is a local connection in that Chanute Air Base. Was one of the things they taught up there was putting out airplane fires, and there was an area that is pretty implicated with forever chemicals, I understand. I don't remember the details about it. There are also some startups growing vegetables there. Okay, and we've got the fracking dilemma in Illinois. I don't think there's been any action congressional at our state house level or at governor's level. There's been pressure some time ago, pre-COVID. It should be coming back, and this should light a fire under it, it seems to me. We don't know what the heck they're injecting in to liberate their petrochemicals. I guess Barbara Gottlieb is a water protector, too. All right, I don't want to ramble on. I do want to play this whiteness of wealth. This is, I just Googled, and if Google's reliable, New York Times hasn't done much about Ms. Brown's work here. And, how did that happen? She gave a keynote address at the TaxCast in the UK, taxjustice.net. No longer need the .uk on the end of it. It's a regular monthly feature. They have seem to be on a summer holiday, but they did put this up. I think they might be working on how to respond to the G6, 7, or 8, however there are many there are now. The recent European meeting. So I'm expecting on something to drop on that sometime soon. I'm anxious to hear what they have to say. And the last one, they said they were bitterly disappointed that the basic corporate tax that they're trying to get all countries to agree to is so low. But the race to the bottom hits the floor pretty low. And yeah, bitterly disappointed, I think, was the exact quote. So her keynote address, I don't know exactly when it was given. It's not dated because this has gone on for years. I don't think she's a socialist. I don't restrict myself, but it does. But she's done a lot of really great research, it seems to me, over the objections of her colleagues and the consternation. She has a section in here where she talks about liberal denialism, I would call it, something like that. But there's also something missing in the feminist range. She talks a lot about two-income families. Well, I'll let her say it since it looks like I'm going to have to get to it right away if I want to make way for the Radio Free Labor show coming up. 2 hours of Radio Free Labor. And I commend it to your attention. I regularly listen to it, even if I'm watching soccer at the same time, which I won't be today. And Amazon Prime has gotten the Premier League, and it's... Oh, I'm apoplectic again.
Hello and welcome to this TaxCast Extra from the Tax Justice Network. I'm Naomi Fowler. I'm the host and producer of the Tax Justice Network's podcast, The TaxCast. You'll find it on your podcast app. Please do subscribe as well. Make sure you never miss an episode. You can just ping me an email on naomi@taxjustice.net or subscribe through our website on www.thetaxcast.com. We've had the honour before of speaking on the TaxCast with Law Professor Dorothy Brown. She's been doing trailblazing work on systemic racism and tax justice in the United States for many years. She's author of the book The Whiteness of Wealth: How the US Tax System Impoverishes Black Americans and How We Can Fix It. You'll find a link to the book in the show notes, along with some other further listening and reading. In this TaxCast Extra, you can hear Professor Brown's keynote speech, which she gave to the Tax Justice Network's annual conference. Here's Professor Brown.
So I'm going to talk a little bit about my research, the reaction that, I should say, the negative reaction that I've received from some of the research, as well as what might be possible in moving forward in the U.S. with respect to tax reform. So my book, The Whiteness of Wealth, is broken up into several chapters, and I'm just going to talk briefly about the research in each of the chapters. There is a marriage chapter, a homeownership chapter, a college chapter, a jobs chapter, a legacy chapter, and what potential tax reform plans going forward might be worth considering if what we want is a tax system that doesn't enhance white wealth, but instead enhances black wealth building. So let's start with marriage, which really is the first thing I ever wrote about race and taxation. And I'm going to start with saying the U.S. IRS system, Internal Revenue System, that is the mechanism in the government for collecting tax returns and processing them, they don't publish statistics by race. Why the IRS doesn't publish statistics by race is a question that I can't answer because they've never said why, right? They have published statistics on gender. They've published statistics on age. But they've never published statistics on race, and the IRS commissioner has testified recently, like in the last month or so, that that's not the IRS's job, that that's Treasury's job, so it's a lot of finger pointing, but I think now is a moment where people are going to be holding the IRS commissioner as well as the Secretary of Treasury accountable. So when I decided to write about race and tax, I didn't even realize that the IRS did not publish statistics by race, so how on earth was I ever going to publish anything? Well, I had to become a detective, and I would read material on race that had nothing to do with tax, but bring my tax lens into it. And I came across a report on the status, the economic status of Black women, and there was a line in there that said, married Black women contribute roughly 41% to household income, and married white women contribute 29%. Now, to someone who's not a tax geek, it wouldn't mean anything. But to me, I was basically jumping out of my seat, because I knew that the joint return, which is a filing mechanism, right, for married couples, the joint return disadvantages two equal wage earner households. If two spouses earn roughly equal amounts, the tax laws in America don't help them. If one spouse earns 100% of the income or close to 100% of the income, the tax laws benefit them. So that statistic that said married Black wives contribute 41% to household income told me that the penalty for marriage was going to be disproportionately received by Black married couples like my parents. So that sentence was nice, but it wasn't necessarily going to hold up an entire article. So what I did was worked with an institute at the University of Cincinnati, where I was teaching at the time, that looked at Census Bureau data for the entire United States of America, pulled out married couples and pulled out white married couples and pulled out Black married couples. And lo and behold, the research in the Census Bureau proved what I thought it would, which is mainly at all income levels, married Black couples are more likely to be in 50-50 or 40-60 households, which means they're going to pay a penalty. But married white couples are more likely to be in single wage earner households where it's 100-0 or 90-10 split. They get a tax cut when they get married. So here we have just one provision, the joint return, that as I did research for the book, I found out came into existence because of a rich white couple named Charlotte and Henry Seaborn. At the very beginning of our modern US income tax system, the only people who pay taxes were rich Americans. Everybody else didn't pay taxes because they didn't earn enough money. Well, the rich Americans were white Americans, and they didn't like the fact that they were the only ones paying taxes and they had wealth. So they would then engage in schemes or ideas to decrease the amount of taxes that they paid. And one of their schemes was Henry Seaborn deciding to just treat his wife as if she got half of his income. And because we're in a progressive tax system, splitting the income between those two cut their tax bill. Well, there was one problem. The law didn't allow it. So the IRS said, you can't do it. And they fought in court and went all the way up to the Supreme Court. They said, yeah, you can do it. Fast forward to 1948, Congress decides to make what the Seaborns got applicable across the country in the joint return. And ultimately, that caused married Black couples to pay higher taxes. So it's an example of tax policy in the US built on white norms, how white Americans did marriage, not how Black Americans did marriage, because Black wives always worked outside in the paid labor market more than white wives. So one point, I was presenting this research at a tax professor conference, and the first comment was directed at me, and the academic said, well, Dorothy, everybody knows your work is irrelevant because Blacks are poor and don't pay a lot in taxes. So this was kind of the norm, right? I would often get criticized for writing about race and tax when the profession recognized class, but thought race had nothing to do with it because after all, as this person said, Blacks are poor, don't pay a lot in taxes. The problem, however, is most Blacks are not poor. And even if you want to focus on the poor who are Black, we have something called an earned income tax credit that has significant penalties if you're married. And as your income increases, the tax credit decreases such that the tax rate on low-income taxpayers eligible for our earned income tax credit is a high marginal tax rate. So even poor people wind up getting disadvantaged with tax policy. So the next chapter in the book is on home ownership. And what my research showed, again, IRS doesn't publish statistics on race, so I had to go to sociology research to look at how home ownership operated on the ground between white and Black Americans. And what I found out was depending on how many Black Americans live in your neighborhood determines how much your home will appreciate. If you're in an all white or virtually all white neighborhood, that's where most of the home ownership appreciation is. And that's where most white homeowners want to live. If you live in a racially diverse or an all Black neighborhood, you don't get as much appreciation out of your home. And the research also shows that there's a different tax treatment for selling your home at a gain versus selling your home at a loss. Selling your home at a gain, you can get up to $500,000 of gain tax-free. But if you sell your home at a loss, you don't get a tax break. And I know it's gonna surprise you, white and Black Americans don't do homeownership the same way. Most Black Americans live in racially diverse or all Black neighborhoods. And in those neighborhoods, Black homeowners are more likely to sell their home for a loss. If you live in an all-white neighborhood, you're more likely to sell your home for a gain and a tax-free gain up to $500,000. So if you want to get equity, if you want to get wealth out of home ownership, in theory, you want to live in an all-white neighborhood or be one of the only Black families in the neighborhood. But there are problems with being the only Black family in the neighborhood. You know, there are lots of newspaper reports that tell us that white neighbors don't know what their Black neighbors look like, so they call the police on them when they're just trying to get into their own home. If you have a child that goes to a school, then you have teachers that will see your child engaging in the same behavior that white peers do, but the teacher calls your child out. Suddenly, your child is in detention, or your child has to go see the principal. So there are issues that I call racism triage that Black homeowners have to deal with if they want to be that one Black family in an all-white neighborhood so that they can have the opportunity to get up to $500,000 of tax-free gain. Well, this is another example of how did we get this provision that gain on the sale of a home should be tax-free? Well, it dates back to the 1950s when the defense industry in the United States was gearing up and they needed workers to move from one part of the country to the other. Well, the 1940s had been a time where the federal government was helping white Americans become homeowners. So for the first time in 1950, we have a majority of white Americans are homeowners. And if they want to sell their home and move to get a defense job, they're going to pay taxes. Well, tax policy said, no, you won't have to pay taxes, right? So tax policy in the early 1950s helped white Americans who were homeowners. A significantly lower percentage of Black Americans were homeowners. And we know the defense industry wasn't gearing up to hire a lot of Black workers. It was all about white workers who happened to be homeowners. So this piece, my research on homeownership, I'd say got more pushback than virtually anything else I've ever written. Why? Because white law professors like to think of themselves as progressive, as liberal, as good on race. And what my piece told them is they were living in these all-white neighborhoods, let's be clear. And they wanted to say, oh, it wasn't about race, it was about all these other things. But the research showed that it really was only about race. So they didn't want to believe this wealth gap was about race. They wanted to believe it was anything else. And one academic said to me that it was actually a good thing that the house in Black neighborhoods didn't appreciate that much, because it meant other first-time Black homeowners could buy in the neighborhood and buy a cheap house, which was mind-numbing to me, because who wants to make that much of an investment, which is what it takes to buy a house, to have very little upside? And besides, if it was such a good investment, we would see lots of white homeowners doing it, and we don't, right? So I got a lot of craziness with respect to the homeownership piece, because it just made the academics lose their minds, basically, because they didn't want to face the reality that they, in fact, were living, you know, had homes in these all-white neighborhoods. Well, the next chapter in the book deals with college. And this was the first thing I'd written about college. So this was new for me. And the research on college was awfully difficult to locate. There isn't anything in one place, right? So I looked for debt loads. I looked for gifts and inheritances that pay for college. And it was an amalgamation of sources that led me to the overall conclusion, which is Black Americans who go to college are more likely to leave with higher debt loads than their white peers. If their white peers leave with debt, it's lower and they pay it off quickly. And also their white peers are more likely to have parents and grandparents who pay for college. So that the tax subsidy for debt load is you get an interest deduction for student loan debt, but it's capped at $2,500. And if you look at the high debt loads of Black Americans, the $2,500 doesn't allow a lot of Black student debt loan holders to deduct all of their interest. Whereas if you look at what the typical student loan debt for white borrowers were, you see that they can amortize their debt and pay and not reach the cap of $2,500. So what we see in tax law for higher education is limited subsidies if you pay for it yourself, and unlimited subsidies if somebody else pays for it. So gifts and inheritances that your relatives pay for your college is tax-free. So this chapter was, I think, the most depressing for me, because I came across the statistic that showed 60% of Black Americans who start college don't graduate. 60%. But they often leave with debt. And the whole theory behind taking on debt to go to college is you graduate and you get that better paying job. But if you leave college with debt and no degree, you have the debt and you don't have the better paying job. So this chapter, the pushback that I've gotten from folks who have heard about it or read it is by white Americans who say, I didn't have anybody pay for my college. I paid for it myself, which of course has nothing to do with my chapter, right? My chapter doesn't say every white person has their college paid for. My chapter says that lots of white Americans have their college paid for, and it's paid for in a tax-free manner. The other piece of the tax subsidy is not-for-profit colleges, you know, Harvard, Yale, Emory. What we see is those institutions with huge endowments that pay very little taxes, and without the 2017 tax cuts, it was zero taxes, but now it's a small amount of taxes. Those colleges and universities are not welcoming places for Black Americans, but they have this tax subsidy that basically goes for the benefit of their majority white student bodies. So even though these institutions would tell you they're doing so much better, they're doing outreach, they're doing all these things, in the last 30 years, the enrollment of Black students has not budged. So what we see is this tax subsidies for these very rich billion-dollar endowed institutions, and those tax subsidies are not going for Black students. In fact, one of the programs that helps Black students are our Pell Grants. And our Pell Grants have not kept up with inflation, and they pay for very little of college. So one suggestion I have is we should tax endowments of very wealthy institutions and fully fund Pell Grants so that Black students could actually, with need, could graduate college debt-free. The next chapter is about jobs and looking at the tax-free benefits that come with good jobs, health insurance, retirement accounts, and what the labor market shows us is there's occupational segregation. There are white jobs and there are Black jobs. And it's not going to surprise you at this point. The white jobs tend to be the ones that come with tax-free benefits like health insurance and retirement accounts. The Black jobs tend to not come with those. And even when you have a Black worker who works for an employer that provides these benefits, Black Americans are less likely to participate. Why is that? Because our money goes elsewhere. Research shows Black college graduates are more likely to send money to their parents. White college graduates are more likely to receive money from their parents that they then use to build wealth. Black college graduates, on the other hand, are ones financially supporting extended family members who were the victim of Jim Crow, who were the victim of segregation, illegal race discrimination. Because of that, we are less likely to participate in our retirement accounts. But there's also research that shows equally qualified Black college graduates have a harder time getting those good paying jobs. They have to send more resumes in order to get interviews. And when they're offered positions, they're offered lower paying positions, even though they are qualified and apply for higher paying positions. So one of the solutions I've suggested is, well, if an employer is discriminating in how they pay wages, then perhaps we should not allow them to deduct their wages. I got a response to that. You're turning the IRS into the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, and that's wrong. And what's interesting about that comment is Congress itself passed a law that said you cannot deduct compensation unless it's reasonable. Well, why couldn't we define reasonable as not discriminatory on the basis of race, right? Of course we could. So when Congress says you only get a deduction for wages if it's reasonable, it really causes us to think, well, what's reasonable? Is discriminating on the basis of race reasonable? It shouldn't be. Okay, so that's the jobs chapter. And then the legacy chapter, how do white Americans build up wealth compared with how Black Americans build up wealth? A lot of inheritance, a lot of family financial transfers from the parents pay for their grandchildren to go to private school. Therefore, the parents don't have to pay for it. Therefore, they can save money and invest. Whereas Black Americans, I mentioned before, less likely to get an inheritance. And when we do, we are less likely to be able to use the inheritance to build wealth. Why? Because we're usually using it to support extended family members. So the pushback I often get here is, well, I didn't get inheritance. And it's really interesting when white Americans push back on the notion that our tax system is designed to help build white wealth, is I know if I had a 10-minute conversation with them, I could quickly pull out where their whiteness helped build their wealth, right? They don't see it. But if you talk with people, as I've done over the years, within a few questions, I can see it. So that's usually the, I didn't inherit it. And actually, there are white families that I talk about in my book. They didn't necessarily inherit it, but they got a loan that enabled them to buy real estate in New York that, you know, skyrocketed in value. Or they had a friend who worked in the stock market and taught them how to invest. So there are lots of ways that whiteness helps you build wealth that there just isn't that access for Black Americans. So I want to close with talking about what might be next in U.S. with respect to race and tax reform. So first, when the book came out, I was approached by Congress to testify. I testified before the Senate Finance Committee, and I testified before a House committee. In 20-something years of doing this research, I've never been asked to testify before Congress. So I will say that the publicity that the book has gotten has caused some people in Congress to take notice and to be interested in thinking through how we might publish statistics on race and tax. President Biden in January of this year signed a racial equity executive order, which told his government, the political appointees in each of the branches of government, each of the departments, to disaggregate data by race. And of course, the department I'm most interested in is the Treasury Department, because they put out lots of statistics, none of which have anything to do with race. And I must say the Treasury Department is giving me no cause for optimism, because they've done nothing so far. They talked, but they've done actually nothing. So I'm cautiously optimistic that something could come out of Congress, as well as the president could decide to make it clear to Treasury that they have to make race and tax statistics a priority. So I'm optimistic and pessimistic all at the same time. You know, this is a systemic problem, so we need a systemic solution. Now, in each chapter, I call it small solutions. So the solution to the joint return is to just have individual filing, have marriage not change our tax bill. The solution to home ownership, in my opinion, is getting rid of these subsidies for home ownership that disproportionately benefit white homeowners. With college, we should start taxing these private institutions that are very wealthy and fund Pell Grants and other things. With respect to jobs, we should have employers required to publish statistics, do an audit, their own audit, and publish statistics on racial disparities in pay and racial disparities in take up on retirement accounts and health insurance. And we should think about taxing gifts and inheritances that go to wealth building and not go to supporting extended family members. So there are individual changes, and then I think there are bigger changes. So to me, the solution is a radically different tax code than we have now. It is kind of going back to basics, what we had at the beginning of the 20th century in the United States, where we had very few loopholes and deductions. And only if you made more than a living allowance would you pay taxes. So that it would basically have one rate, well, it would be a progressive tax rate, but one rate system that would apply whether you ran Amazon or whether you worked in a warehouse. So we would tax income from capital the same way we tax income from labor. And there's this pushback against talking about race, period. And I think it's time for allies to step up and say, and when I say allies, white allies, to step up and say, one, we need to teach real history in school. If you want to talk about what's going wrong, it's talking about slavery, for example, as something that benefited the slaves, right? We were kind to the slaves. That's what a lot of history books in America say. So if we really want to, if we want to get real, then we can talk about, yeah, our history books, they don't tell the truth. Let's talk about telling the truth. And to push back on the notion that we cannot talk about race because the IRS has not talked about race and it hasn't stopped Black people from paying higher taxes. So not talking about race is a design mechanism to maintain the status quo of white supremacy. How do you know what potential problems there are if you don't look? And when you look, then you learn and you figure out what your solution is. I think the states, for example, in the United States should take up the charge on who's paying sales taxes, who's paying excise taxes by race. So yes, we should have more of it, not less. And in terms of how do we fix it, in my chapter on solutions, I talk about Black taxpayers who gave themselves a tax credit for racism and they wound up in prison, right? So my book, The Whiteness of Wealth, gave lots of examples of white Americans who broke the law and got rewarded for it with a change in tax policy. But when Black Americans try to take what they called a reparations credit, the IRS threw the book at them. So I believe we need to fight smart, right? And you know, the civil rights tradition includes going to jail, civil disobedience, right? But in terms of what the potential solutions are, I think we should think big and we should also think small, that we should have multiple tracks and not think there's one right way to get it done. We should try lots of different things and we should talk about a transformed tax system. So I think it's an and approach as opposed to an or approach.
You've been listening to Professor Dorothy Brown on the TaxCast from the Tax Justice Network. Check out the TaxCast on your podcast app. You can also subscribe through our website, www.thetaxcast.com.
That was Ms. Brown, Professor Brown, The Whiteness of Wealth. Like I said, I have some misgivings about some of her analysis, but the research she's did, I think, needs more hearing. That's why I put it. That was a keynote address she gave to the UK group Tax Justice, Tax Justice Network. As Naomi Fowler there, your hostess, said, you can connect to her on Twitter and find their webpage, taxjustice.net or taxcast.com. I don't forget what it is. Just Google TaxCast, and you can find it in your... I didn't think I was going to get it all on, but here I have a second or two to say something else. Something about Haiti and Cuba tomorrow at 5. I've been looking around alternative media for different views. Probably have something from Sonali Kalhatkar out in L.A. interviewing a Haitian activist. We're just talking about Haiti a little bit off mic. And I think I mentioned it last week, but I did not know that we know that the French got recompense for all their losses, a.k.a. Black Lives. through the decades Haiti was paying this off. The U.S. did not recognize Haiti until after the Civil War. Abe Lincoln did it. And I always thought that was a neat thing, but then I found out, and I can't find any details about how much money was involved, but the U.S. also insisted that if they were going to recognize Haiti as a polity, as a country, that some of their losses